Accession number 12163, Reel 1.
Mr. Fitzjohn, Reel 1. Can you tell me, first of all, where you were born and something about your family background, please?
I was born in Hull, or Kingston upon Hull, August the 18th, 1919.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was... he worked for the Metal Box Company, actually. He was what is known as a die setter. And,
Where did you go to school?
Well, the local elementary school, Selby Street. And I must mention this, though I passed my scholarship with comparative ease, I had the choice of going to work or going to a secondary school, and I went to work, which I have often regretted. And yet I've lived a good life, so I've no complaints.
What job did you go into?
I was a storeman on the fish docks in Hull. Leaving school until, well, the outbreak of war.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I was still working as a storeman.
Did you hear the broadcast when Chamberlain made...
Definitely. We were filling sandbags on top of the old Anderson shelter in the garden when the war was declared.
What impact did the broadcast make on you?
Well, I'd had a medical weeks and weeks before war broke out, and I was just waiting to be getting my papers to go in the army, and it got to the state where I thought they'd forgotten me. I still had Christmas at home, but anyhow, the 20th of January, I reported to the Royal Armoured Corps Training Regiment at Perham Down in Wiltshire, near Salisbury and Tidworth, that area.
How did you feel about the prospect of the war?
Well,
at that time,
the actual war. Well, naturally, you're indignant at this man Hitler, but I was more indignant at the thought of getting called into the army when Hor Belisha first mentioned about a militia. I had the impression of all the louts and vagabonds were regular soldiers. And I'm afraid I got the shock of my life when I got to Perham Down. Within two or three days, I found out I enjoyed it. I thought the army was good.
So you had a low opinion of the army?
Till I actually went. And then I realised that instead of... Luckily, I wasn't in a... I didn't do infantry training. We're doing driving, theory and practical, wireless, gunnery, map reading. It was like going to school again, actually. And from my point of view, I enjoyed the 6 months of training and I thought it was very good.
But would you say that you had patriotic feelings about being part of...
Definitely, yes. Yes, first of all, I'm a Yorkshireman, but I'm also an Englishman, right or wrong, as they say in my country. Oh, yes. I often argue with people, no, if they're dissatisfied with England, well, they want to go elsewhere. I consider I was lucky to be born here.
Can you describe what the training was like?
Well, a lot of it was classroom. You were learning Morse and wireless and the theory of driving and maintenance, and then we advanced from that to the practical side, and it was quite good. I enjoyed it.
And how were you treated by those in charge?
Quite good. See, actually, we were what we called... We were 20 squad of the 54th Armoured Corps Training Regiment, and the squad prior to us was the last squad of the militia. So we were the first actual wartime squad of the 54th Training Regiment. And the threat is quite good. They're all decent chaps.
Was it hard?
No. No, it's quite good. I say I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I was learning things and I thought I really enjoyed it. And I won't say otherwise.
How long did the training last for?
Approximately 6 months. Up to about the time of Dunkirk. That's practically 6 months. Well, in that time, you must remember, things were a bit desperate then, weren't they? I was supposed to have to know gunnery, wireless, driving and maintenance. You had to have all that lot thrust into your mind in 4 or 5 months, which I consider I absorbed most of it.
Was there anything you found hard?
No. And there was no physical hardship because I'll have to be careful here what I say. I was a keen physical culturist before the war. And in fact, after the war, in 1949, I was at the Scala Theatre in London, lifting in the British Weightlifting Championships, which I came runner-up. I know that's nothing to do with the war, but it proves that I had no ill effects from being a prisoner of war or my army training.
So you were into bodybuilding?
No, competitive weightlifting. I was a middleweight, and at 75 kilos, I had to stop at 11 stone 11. I was tempted to, my body wanted to be more, but I kept it down, and I broke various British records, two which I still hold. But we'll forget weightlifting, we're talking of the war, aren't we?
What do you remember about the Dunkirk crisis?
Well, not a great lot. I know that I was supposed to be going to the 1519th King's Royal Hussars, to give them the full title. And, of course, it must have all happened in the few days. Dunkirk happened. And eventually, I was posted to Rowmarsh near Rotherham. Met at the station. And, as the regiment came back in dribbles and drabs and dribbles, there were put in civilian billets. When we arrived, a few of us, we were just paraded around the streets, knocking at people's doors. And in the end, there was my friend and I were in this civilian billet. It was quite, they were quite nice to us, naturally. And we stopped there for about a week or a fortnight, and it was a comparative holiday. We used to parade at the local swimming pool each morning, but it was absolutely chaotic. Dunkirk was still on, and the invasion was probably any minute. And from there I went to the 43rd Royal Tank Regiment, who, of course, at that time had no tanks. We had Austin 600 weights with a Bren on the sticking out the top. That was our tanks, and we were doing coastal defence work on Northumberland along the coast in the area of Alnwick, Bamborough. And
what did you think of the coastal defences which existed on the Northumberland coast then?
Well, as I think back, at the time I didn't realise, but as I think back now, they were pretty pathetic. A few pillboxes. I think we treat it more or less as a joke. We still had great faith that Hitler wouldn't invade. I couldn't see him invade, even though everything was in his favour. I had great confidence that he wouldn't.
Why did you have such confidence?
I don't know. Just the fact, probably, that I was English. But he, bloody fella, had the cheat to. And then, of course, after that, I went to the 42nd Royal Tank Regiment, and we sailed in April 1941 on the SS Aronda. I've always remembered the name, and I've never heard of it since. I assume that after our convoy it must have been sank. And we were escorted by the Repulse, which a few months later was sank by the Japs with the King George the Fifth. It's a long time ago, isn't it? The Prince of Wales and the Repulse, yes. But we had 4 days in Durban, 4 days of paradise, lights and unlimited chocolate and whatever you wanted.
Did the people there do anything?
Marvellous, yes. The first day ashore, after stuffing ourselves with oranges and smoking like chimneys and getting drinks bought us, we were dragged onto a bus by a crowd of girls and whipped off to a place called Rossborough, which was a suburb of Durban. And the entire population were either first or second generation South Africans, all of Scottish origin. It was just like being in Scotland. And we had a big, well, I'm saying a bun fight, you can imagine what I mean. We had a big meal and dancing and entertainment put on, and we had 4 days of, after being weeks and weeks and weeks in a convoy, you can imagine what it was like to be in Durban. And there was a girl, took my name and address, and I've still got the letter she sent to my mother to tell her that it was. And I don't know whether this I can't understand, the security. She said in the letter, like, oh, we always look forward to the Imperial boys coming here. She said, we know weeks ahead when the convoys are coming and prepare for it. Which I thought often afterwards, it was very good security, wasn't it? But anyhow, from there, 4 days in Durban, we went to Egypt. And we went to this camp, Sidi Bish, on the outskirts of Alexandria. Well, when we arrived, our tanks had been sent through the Mediterranean, the short route. And we thought at first they'd been sank, but they'd been collared by the army before, while we were still on the high seas and used in Operation Battle Axe. So we arrived, the tank regiment, with no tanks. And after doing, after doing various guard duties around Alexandria, mainly at the Wardian tank workshops and General Electric Company offices, various places. At that time I was driving a three-tonner, I was a duty driver, mainly going for rations and different things. And then we went to Abbasia near Cairo, practically the entire regiment, and we all went and did refresher courses, and I was there as a driver mechanic, and I should think we were there for, it's hard to say, maybe up to 2 months, which again was very pleasant. I used to go in Heliopolis on a night. To me it was another paradise, sit there with beautiful weather in shorts and shirts. It's quite good.
How did you get on with the local Egyptians?
Well, not that they were more amusing than anything. I'll give you an example. You'd go out on a night, and probably talking to your friend, and you'd be aware of something touch your leg up, your foot behind you, and you'd look around and be a little Arab boy. He'd cleaned one of your shoes till it was shiny like a mirror, and the other one was left covered in dust. His hand was out for the piastres to do with the other shoe. That's sort of stuck in my mind. They were very, to make money, they were very good. And various items. Another thing that goes in my mind about Cairo and Alexandria, there used to be the trams, or the electric trams. There were like three joined together, you know, and a guard at the back with a hunting horn, all that patter. And you could be travelling along, they must have been going 40-odd mile an hour. And if you were on the inside, you could look between the tracks, and you'd pass an old Arab laid fast asleep on a blanket or a carpet in the middle of the two tracks with trains dashing backwards and forwards about 40 miles an hour. And if you were on the other side of the carriage, the outside, and the window was open, suddenly a hand had come through. If you were smoking, your cigarette went through. It would be fumbling with your pocket to pinch your pay book. And they were immediately on and off, the young lads. And I think lots and lots of soldiers lost their pay books through that.
Why did they want pay books?
I don't know, but they used to... Well, I assume the first essential was money. And most of them had the pay book in that top pocket and they whipped the pay book by mistake. But that's my impression of the Egyptians. I had nothing against them. They were... I mean, let's face it, most of them had nothing. And I didn't... In the camp at Sidi Bish, we had what they called the Dobie Wallers and Tailors and that. We used to get on all right with them.
Did you have anything stolen personally?
No, I didn't, no. And then another thing of Alexandria, towards 2 or 3 days before payday, when we were getting a bit broke, we used to go... I always remember George's Bar in Alexandria. And we used to... On the counter were saucers full of nuts and little titbits. And we'd buy a bottle of Stella beer and share it between about four of us and empty the saucers of food. Which, luckily, I think George was a Greek. But he never used to say anything. But... I thought he didn't make much profit from it. One bottle of Stella beer and all of his food used to go. And another thing, we used to go to Shafto's cinemas. A man called Shafto had cinemas all over, which I think he sold actually to the Nafi at the end of the war, but that's another story. And we used to go to the cinema and there'd be 90% of the audience would be British troops, the other 10%... the educated type of Egyptian in the European suit with the red fez, and they'd play His Britannic Majesty God Save the King, which everybody stood up.
Including the Egyptians?
Yes. Then they used to play the Egyptian national anthem, which everyone, I don't repeat the words, but the soldiers used to sing about King Farouk. King Farouk, he's one of those, and a crook. I've often thought, I never saw any fights or arguments, but I wonder what the reactions of those Egyptians was to it. That was one thing I was actually ashamed of, that we all used to sing at the top of our voices this. And then we used to get on to about second verse was Queen Farida, his wife, but anyway. You'll think my life was just a huge joke, won't you, the way I'm telling you these stories.
So, when you sang this mock-up of the national anthem, did the Egyptians react or object?
No, I've never known them.
Maybe they didn't understand?
Well, I think so. I think most of them, they were an educated type, yeah. They weren't the fellaheen, they weren't the peasants. Oh, and also... if I can bring it up. I met a gentleman in Stanley Bay in Alexandria, an Egyptian, and I was running around in my trunks and he must have observed that I was just slightly better built than the others. Don't look at me now. And he took me to a gymnasium in Alexandria and I met, which of course nowadays is history, but in the 1936 Olympic Games, the Egyptian weightlifters won nearly all the classes. They were the top in the world then. In fact, I thought Hitler would have had them shot. All the famous Germans were getting defeated. But then I was introduced to two of their Olympic team and I trained with them a bit, but naturally not much. They were too good for me. But it was just in passing. But I found them quite all right, the Egyptians.
Did the British troops in Egypt behave themselves, apart from singing this national anthem?
Well, You said British. I was going to say in Durban, the Australians, you know, in Durban they had the rickshaws and Zulus all complete in headdress and everything, you know, more or less a tourist attraction. Just prior to us landing there, the convoy before us, the drunken Australians had been sitting the Zulus in the rickshaw and racing up down the main streets of Durban, which nobody approved of. But as for British behaviour, we used to, at one time, we weren't fighting the Germans, we were fighting the RAF. If a fight broke, the fights broke out in Alex and Cairo in pubs, and it was all against some poor RAF chap.
Why did you pick on the RAF?
Well, not me particularly, but there must have been idiots to have thought that they blamed the RAF for their absence of planes. Like, where the hell are you? Like, you're never there. Well, they didn't have anything. If a plane came over, well, this is later in the desert I'm talking about, if a plane came over, you knew it was a German. Until, of course, we gradually pulled round and started getting some equipment.
How did these clashes with the RAF usually spark off?
I should think just the fact that they've been drinking too much. People on leave from the desert and load of beer down them and see an RAF uniform and wonder where.
Were people injured?
Oh, no, but there was plenty of fisticuffs and fights over it, and then, of course, it used to get a few more involved, practically a riot.
You actually saw them, did you?
Oh, yes, yeah, we used to always be arguing. But apart from that, I didn't used to particularly go drinking. I used to like going in the... There was the Navy League Club was one of the best places I used to go in. You know, like in Nappy, and there was the...
This was in Alexandria?
Yes, there was one or two very good canteens, and when I was feeling pretty well off, we used to go in Groppies, the famous restaurant, and drink iced Ovaltine, and I remember sending home £2 of tea. I paid the money and hoped for the best. Anyhow, Groppies was a high-class place, and my mother received the tea, I found out afterwards, which was very grateful in those times of rationing.
Did troops use the brothels in Egypt? Or did
yes. Stay clear of no, they were used, but, oh, God above it, absolute filth, I thought. I've seen them, and naturally, you go in a crowd if you go out on a night, and if it was in Alexandria, we always go to Sister Street, that was the brothel area, it was foul. I considered my health more than going in a place like that. And then in Cairo, they call it the Burqa, that was the brothel area. Another absolute, disgusting, I thought.
Why was it so disgusting?
Well, the filth and the behaviour of the old madam sitting at the door. I can't explain it. I could tell you one true story. If one of the lads was daft enough to fall to go with one of the girls, the old madam had charged the others. I forget how much it was, I think about 20 or 30 piastres, and they walked along a corridor and there were all pinholes in the wall and they could look through the pinholes and watch their friend in action at the other side, much to his anger when he came out. But anyway, that being a brothel man, I can't tell you many stories about them.
Did any of your comrades get diseases from
growing? No, I don't recall any of them, no. I think that happened later on in the war, didn't it? More or less in Europe with the Yanks and everything, yeah.
But did you enjoy your free time in Egypt yourself?
Yes, it was very nice weather, and you can imagine just a shirt and shorts and your shoes and go out on the night. It was pleasant.
Were you apprehensive about going into the fighting?
No. And I won't say that what everybody must tell you, that I knew nothing was going to happen to me. I think everybody tells you that, don't they?
Quite often.
You have the some inner feeling that you know you're going to be all right. There's no concrete, no reason for it. I don't know whether it was wishful thinking or what, but I'd got to the state where I knew nothing was going to happen to me. I don't know why. And I didn't sort of bother.
Now, what happened after this period of guard duties in Alexandria?
Well, and the Abbasia, the training there, well, then our next job was Operation Crusader.
Can we go on to that now? And can you give me as much detail as you can recollect about that personally?
Yes. I will tell you this much. I have blanks in my mind at times of different things. I don't know whether it's a natural reaction or what, or whether probably my brain cells are going, getting an old man now. But as I say, we were the 1st Army Tank Brigade, which consisted of the 8th Battalion, the 42nd and the 44th. I was in the 42nd. And A and B Squadron of our regiment were the first to be equipped with tanks. They were Matildas. And they went up the desert a week or so before my squadron, C Squadron, followed them up. And they took part in the first battle at Sidi Orma. They lost quite a few tanks, not so many actual casualties among the men, mainly due to a minefield there. But we missed that. We were still coming up the desert. And then the next thing we knew was the absolute chaos of what we call Rommel's Flap. And we were the 13th Corps, and the 30th Corps were north of us, and the object of the exercise was to relieve Tobruk, and the garrison of Tobruk was going to break out of Tobruk and join us. Well, there was some intense fighting at Sidi Rezeg, was one of the main battles, and Fort Capuzzo, I remember those well. But Rommel suddenly broke behind all the English lines and went hell for leather for Egypt. And for days there was British troops and Germans mixed up. Nobody knew what was happening. It was like, to use a local expression, it was like the whole fair milling around. And I think, by a marvellous fluke, I think Rommel missed one of our biggest dumps by about 5 miles in his charge along of petrol, ammunition, food, everything. And in the meantime, we, C Squadron of the 42nd, that was our squadron, we were motoring up the desert, unaware of anything happening. And later, we found out that we were about the only troops between Rommel and Egypt.